Welcome to First Turn, where we play board games for the first time and discuss our immediate reactions. It's like book club, but for board games. I'm Eric. With me is Kiwi.
Hello.
MVP.
Hi.
And special guest Paxton.
Hello.
Previously referred to in episodes as the kid.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Yeah. First, we're going to be playing Galactic Scoundrels, designed by Olivia Dunlap, Joseph J. Williams. The artist is Kevin Cates, and it is published by Little Rock Games.
As in Little Rock, Arkansas?
Yes, that is where they're from. Games
the like the Little Rock Nine?
Oh, also Mercury Games. I think it got picked up mid-Kickstarter.
Oh, okay.
Galactic Scoundrels is a game of space western mayhem for 3 to 5 players that features gambling, lying, cheating, and low-down dirty dealing. Plus, it's in space.
People rarely get what they want, friend. Maybe you wanted to be a rock star, or a famous actress, or a rancher on a quiet backwater moon. Doesn't matter. Fact is, you became a 2-bit pilot instead. For more years than you care to count, you've traveled the seedy underbelly of the galaxy looking for quick jobs with quicker paydays. You're smart enough, you'll just never have the patience to work the long con. I get it. Keep things low risk. Leaves plenty of time for drinking and gambling, plus the comforts of all those pretty strangers you meet along the way. You know what, traveler? All that'd be just fine if it were enough. Only I get the feeling there's an itch of a dream that's been growing on you, and it's getting harder not to scratch. You know the one I mean. One perfect job, a huge jackpot, and then you retire somewhere nice. Well, good news, friend. This is your chance.
2-bit pilot, a.k.a. Kiwi?
I mean, more like a 1-bit. 2-bit seems like a lot.
Double the bit.
Obviously, the creators were very into Han Solo.
So basically they said this game is a mix of Star Wars, Cowboy Bebop, Firefly.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah,
a little bit
yeah.
of Firefly.
So, yeah.
All excellent, excellent shows.
So based on all that description, as well as this box, would you be interested in this game?
Yes, I would.
Yeah, it's an audio medium, so.
Can't just nod.
Head nod.
Yeah. There's no sound waves for head nodding.
Well, I was just nodding. I just thought I could go first.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Perfect.
So you guys wouldn't talk.
So it's a visual indicator to yeah. shut up.
Yeah. Also, right. raising your hand will also help.
Please don't do that. I did skip over mechanics. Let me go over mechanics
real quick.
Yes. This is super important.
BP's favorite part.
Cannot decide if she wants to play or not until she knows the mechanics.
That's
right.
She's
yes. I am mechanics. Very specific.
They are dice rolling, hand management, storytelling, and take that.
Mm. What's take that?
It's sort of like I play a card that screws you.
Mm.
Yeah.
So this is a good backstabbing game.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Watch out.
Mm.
I would say, have we talked about the box?
Well, we said based on the box art and the description,
okay.
So we haven't talked about the box art.
If you would like to describe it.
Yes. So, I mean, I am looking at the box right now. And so it does have a Han Solo-esque figure on the front, but in a more feminine silhouette. Just that it does also say that storytelling aspect. I feel like that would grab my interest, just that it has that storytelling and then space western, and those are things that I would definitely be attracted to. And then it's got, you know, people, a mechanized kind of robotic figure shooting at a humanoid figure in the background. So, you know, pretty simple, not super detailed, but at the same time has enough flash for those who are interested in those types of genres, I would say. Which, again, the whole just Galactic Scoundrels, I think of the Han Solo thing mm-hmm. all the time. The description you read about bluffing and
lying.
Yeah. Yeah, it sounds fantastic.
I think looking at the name, I would probably pick it up. I don't think the box art is anything to write home about. I think it's pretty generic, but mm-hmm. I don't know.
I think it's got a unique style. I mean, it's not like...
It's not Wingspan specific
right.
detail.
It's
right.
not like highly detailed like art, but it's got a kind of a cool sort of
yeah.
vibe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, but they needed to keep it generic just so they weren't
infringing on either Star Wars or Cowboy Bebop or
yeah.
Firefly.
Yes. I don't know. I kind of like the art style. It's got like a gritty look to it, I think.
Yeah, I think it's the kind of art style where you can put anything you want to it. Like, it's not so specific where you're like, well, that's clearly Harrison Ford.
Right.
Or it's general
Yeah,
enough,
they kept it vague.
Yeah,
yes.
that you can make up your own story behind that and you're not affected by... Like, well, you can't do that because that's not what Han Solo would do.
Right. And the brown coloring also brings out kind of that Western thing.
Mm-hmm. It's more Firefly
gritty,
feel,
yeah.
I think, yeah. actually, to the box art.
It's cool. There's some, like, fighting on the sides, somebody gambling on the top. There's a ship in the background.
So it's cool?
Yeah. I'd pick it up.
How about some history?
Yes. Well, the only thing I could come up with on the fly for this one was going with the kind of sci-fi as a genre. And so, interestingly enough, I mean, my immediate was right mid-20th century American culture and cult classics, right? Like 2001, Space Odyssey. You know, I mean, once the whole space race was on between the USSR and the US, right? I mean, there was just a flood of that type of genre that I think eventually led to the classic Star Wars. But apparently after a quick search, there are some people who, like Gulliver's Travel and thing like that, are like headrunners into the sci-fi genre. I don't know if I necessarily agree with that. I would put H.G. Wells and, of course, right,
yeah.
War of the Worlds, so early 20th century still. I don't know that really there's a whole lot of that kind of sci-fi space travel that I think our generation really familiarizes with the sci-fi genre pre-20th century.
It's, Jules Verne and H.G. Wells are kind of like what I've always considered
forerunners.
I would consider Swift very sci-fi.
Yeah.
I guess. I
mean, fantasy-ish.
Yeah.
And I mean, it is a different, supposedly a different planet, but it's not.
Yeah. Fair enough.
Okay, so rules wise, so everybody's going to start the game with five cards in their hand. And those cards are going to have characters, encounters, and traits. And then other things that you can pick up are crew members, cargo, and ships. So the game is going to be played. We're going to draw a job. Somebody has raised their hand. Yes.
So this is starting to remind me, is this somewhat similar to Call to Adventure then with the idea?
I think there are some similar aspects where I think Call to Adventure, everybody's sort of building their own thing.
Right.
And there were, there were hero and anti-hero cards that could affect other people. Mm-hmm. I think more anti-hero cards, but everybody was sort of building their own character. In this game, we're going to sort of compete for a job, and then whoever wins that job is then going to, everyone is going to play to either help or hinder that player complete the job.
Okay.
And you're going to do that with the cards from your hand. So essentially what's going to happen is we're going to pull a job card. So like this example of a job card is titled The Fix Is In. And it says, when Lady Luck needs a helping hand, sometimes you've got to fix things yourself. So the way we're going to see who is going to take the job is it's got sort of a poker-esque bluffing that we're going to start with. It gets to the point where someone's going to say, I think you're a liar. And then the liar would then have to show their cards. So if I say, I have five of a kind, Eric can say, you're a liar. And then I have to show my cards. If I have five of a kind, I am the winner. And then as the winner, I get to start the job. If I'm lying and Eric calls me on it, he'll get one of my cards from my stash and he gets to do the job. The person who takes the job is going to get to do a couple of actions. They're going to be able to take a ship from their stash and play it. And then if they have crew members in their stash, they can also play those. And then from their hand, they can play characters as passengers. And then they also get to draw cargo cards and put their cargo on. And then once they're done and they've done everything they want to, it's going to go clockwise around the table. And then everyone's going to be able to take a card from their hand and play it and tell the story. So there's a big storytelling aspect to this as we're all kind of going around playing different portions of the story. So on these encounter cards, you'll see that there are emblems. The ones that are not faded, as Eric is doing the job, he has to play some card that has those on it. So like, say he's got this crew member on board, the alcoholic ex-marshal. So then you've used that crew member and he gets turned sideways. You can only use him once per job. If your crew member doesn't have the symbol for the encounter or whatever's getting played, you can just discard the crew member. And that's another way to defeat that encounter.
Push them out.
And then there's also twist cards that are in here as well. And so if I play a twist at that point, so say I play the twist. Now, Eric and I have to make a deal because me playing the twist, I have an option. I can either help or I can hurt. And so Eric and I make a deal, and then we're going to roll dice, and there's a list. So you're going to roll two of these space dice. And there's a whole list of things that could help me. But then there's a whole lot of things that could harm him as well. And there's nothing that says you have to honor the deal.
Mm-hmm.
The only rule is if you break a deal and you're on a job at the very end, you cannot win.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a karma. It's karma.
Yeah.
Instant karma.
So that way there's always the risk of mm-hmm. you can't make a future deal. It could break your deal.
Yeah.
And then the game ends once all these cards are gone.
Okay.
We're going to start with episode 4, go episode 5, and episode 6. Totally generic numbering. Yeah. Doesn't match.
Standard, it's normal numbering. Standard. It's mm-hmm. nothing standard, nothing to sue over.
Nothing to see here.
I still number those as 1, 2, and 3.
But you would be wrong, and now we're going to get hate email.
Let's play.
Former sheriff.
We'll call him Brian Burp. The cargo I had that I stole from Paxton was a volatile chemical that I knew from my former days as a school child was very bad for space whales. So I did a quick turn and jettisoned it out the back, and the space whale went for it. And in the confusion, I ran away.
That was the last of its kind. They're now extinct.
Yeah. Which doesn't bother me. You were watched by Brian Burp.
Brian Burp is back?
The righteous lawman.
But he's not a drunkard.
No, not this one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
This is his cousin.
Jurl Earp, the righteous lawman, not a drunk. Actually, his grandmother's very proud of him for that. She's very disappointed in Brian Burp.
In good old Cowboy Bebop style.
Nope. IP infringement.
Okay. So, in good old what classical Western style, I'll whip out my slingers, spin them around. Earl is so fascinated by my fast moves, doesn't see the bullets come out.
And as he dies, he says, "My name is Jurl." So, it's Merle Burp, the son of Jurl Burp. Okay. Second cousin of Brian Burp.
Right.
From the very illustrious Burp family.
Apparently.
That I am going to basically ransom and blackmail to return.
To his grandmother. Who
grandmother. Maisel Burp. Who very much loves her grandson. Yeah, me, my traveling circus performer, and Merle Burp. Who's locked out in the hold.
So as the ransom courier has shown up, you're hiding in like in a star system waiting for them to show up, and then the sun goes supernova.
Oh god.
So in that case,
sadly you explode.
Unbeknownst to you, was infected.
Oh snap.
With a deadly virus that targets especially female humans named Maisel.
Fortunately, I've got these rare space whale babies that I'm carrying. That the contagion is actually like, you know, it's aiming for Maisel, but you can't pass up space whale. That's delicacy.
Yeah.
So we just finished a game of Galactic Scoundrels. To recap, Paxton came in third with 201 space dollars. BP came in second with 220 space dollars. I was first place with 372 space dollars. And Kiwi is not a very good scoundrel. He had like 10 bucks.
And those were thousands.
Oh, thousands, yeah. So 10,000, 220K, etc. I don't know that I had a strategy. Just try to win. Yeah, I don't. Did anyone have a strategy?
No, I mean, whatever strategy I had, even if I had one, it's not good.
We don't want to hear your strategy. Paxton, what was your strategy?
My strategy was mostly to steal other people's money and try to get a soda.
Yeah.
I actually thought that the crew members would be more helpful, and so I really actually was thoughtful about selecting crew and wanting to have crew stashed, but we can talk about that when we get further along. So
yeah. Okay. So what did we think of the theme?
Space theme?
Space theme. Space scoundrel theme.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think the, you know, Star Wars, Firefly, Cowboy Bebop, those are all shows that I enjoy. I think everybody, you haven't seen Cowboy Bebop.
I haven't seen any of the things that you said besides Star Wars.
Yeah.
You should probably those are, Firefly.
Yeah, those mm-hmm. are some of my favorite portions of, like, those genres. So,
yeah,
I like the theme, yeah.
I'm with you. It's, I mean, that's why this was a Kickstarter that I backed, and it was basically just because it said that theme. I was like, yeah, I'm in. Do you think it, did it capture that experience?
Yeah, that's one thing I wanted to bring up, especially, like, with the cards, the job cards, I feel like really set the stage for mm-hmm. that. I mean, they're really well written, and, yeah, I think they just really sell,
I like, think
set the mood, if you will, at the beginning.
Of a lot of storytelling games kind of give you a lot of the story. I think this left it very vague, so you could kind of just make it up yourself.
Yeah.
I think it was fun to build off of other people's stories and then just, like, make crazy twists, like finding a secret hatch under Dad's chair or
supernovas.
Yeah.
How about the art?
Yeah, I think it's good. I think it sticks with the box art in that simplistic grittiness. And obviously the art is a little bit more important in these because you have to be able to identify clearly the different symbols. Yeah, so I think it was useful. Again, I think it's like as we talked about at the beginning with the box art. It's not super detailed, but it doesn't need to be, and it's clear.
The one thing I did wish it add on the twist, it would add what it was. So, like, instead of just having the two arrows and the dot, it had, like, the picture of what it was, like a picture of a spy or the picture of the bomb or the supernova.
But I think, though, the way that it's set up does the same thing that someone had just said, I can't, if it was you, Eric, that allows it to be more open-ended.
It does. Yeah. But, I mean, I could see what you're saying. They kind of went with simple iconography, which mm-hmm. they, you know, instead of having, like, a weird logo in the corner or something, it's just, that is the picture. It's just kind of a more elaborate, like, icon than you might have in another game. Like, this is a sentient laser pistol, but it's still just the weapon symbol.
Right.
Or an obsessive compulsive mechanic is still just that. So, like, I agree that I think we could just say the twist icon maybe is a little more boring compared to the other ones, I would say.
Yeah, I think the only ones that really had, like, art were the ships and the cargo. Because the cargo,
yes,
like this one, the cargo that screams a lot, and then it's just a box, which they all have the same generic box, but then they have some kind of graphic to go along with it. It's like radioactive cargo has a puddle below the cargo.
Right.
So, but I think it's important. I think BP, you brought it up and we brought it up in the beginning about being super generic
mm-hmm.
because if you're too specific, then like your story fits what's on that card.
Right.
Whereas, you know, a box for cargo, you know, the explosive cargo, I dropped it on the courthouse for the judge that was trying to find me. And I blew
right.
up the courthouse with my
right.
explosive cargo.
I mean, I think the obvious comparison for us is Call to Adventure. Very storytelling games. And I think that's a big difference is like that one has such vivid artwork that's sort of like,
yes,
you kind of is telling the story and then you just play off of that versus this, which is very sort of very generic artwork that you can kind of build your own story. So it's sort of just different approaches.
Yeah.
Yeah. Although at the same time, I feel like with Call to Adventure, well, I feel like I really actually barely looked at the art on the cards.
Oh, I did. I enjoyed it.
It's very nice looking, but I think, yeah, it lends itself more to the whole theme of that game as well, the art. Whereas I feel like, again, as we had started this one off, being kind of gritty, you don't need fancy art for it.
Right. Yeah. Well, I don't think it would have hurt. I think I'm assuming it was probably a cost savings thing.
Oh, yeah.
Because they're a smaller publisher. How about the mechanics?
Oh, that's right. Everybody stares at me about mechanics as I'm waiting for someone who actually cares about mechanics to pipe up. For all serious, like the bluffing piece, I think we had, and the storytelling piece, and I think we've said this in previous podcasts, we do tend to like storytelling kind of games. And this one, as we have been talking already, really opens itself up to create imaginative stories that build on each other, as Paxton had said, as a good component. So I don't know if that's a mechanic or not.
Storytelling, I think, would be a mechanic. I think that's my favorite part. Like, I didn't like necessarily like the bluffing piece as much in this game. I wish there was a different way to just pick or like just do a thing at the beginning where, you know, this player is first person and they get first crack of the job. And then you just go clockwise around the table for people getting a chance to do the job. Not that it was bad. It's just the bluffing games that we've played so far. The only one that I've really enjoyed is Sheriff of Nottingham and the other bluffing game.
This seemed more of like a tacked on bluff versus like a major mechanic like Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah.
I didn't dislike it, but.
Yeah, and I would have liked the Sheriff of Nottingham kind of like, if you make a deal this round, you have to honor it.
Right.
If it makes it very
for later
difficult.
On, then you don't have to honor it. Like, I think if we played it again, I would almost say, like, house rule it to that.
We've talked about house rules. This table rules, though, for the rules section. Yep. Paxton?
I thought it was pretty fun.
The mechanics.
The mechanics. Like, how the game plays.
Yeah.
I liked it. The bluffing was pretty fun because I didn't bluff.
He did call everybody for bluffing.
Yeah. So on my first try, though, I caught Eric.
Yeah, and you caught?
No, I.
Nope.
No, you caught
Kiwi. Yeah.
Yeah, so I didn't exactly perfect the lie detector.
No.
Right.
I didn't get close. But I mean, I got some cash. So.
Yep.
Yeah, so the mechanics, I think, hand management. I think that was good.
Yeah, storytelling.
It's mostly the storytelling, I think, is the biggest piece. Bluffing. I didn't dislike it, but I'm kind of with you in that. Like, one of the kind of complaints that I've seen is, like, somebody didn't get a job the whole game. You know, I personally thought it was fun when you were not necessarily on the job. I thought that was fine, but I could see, you know, like you said, if maybe you just went around and everyone kind of had a shot or something, then it would be, you know, I don't know, maybe better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because it could be like, you know, instead of going until the cards are out, you go a certain number of rounds and then whoever has the most at that point. And then.
But I feel like, though, then those who went left, like, I think you still have to do it with the getting rid of all the deck, all the cards, because otherwise the people who then have a round at the
I might have to do stuff with the scale. Yeah, but and that was another thing I was going to say is like the way they scale up, like those last jobs are part of the game. Mm-hmm. Like.
Well, and it's expected, too, by then that you, again, hand management and how it works, that you've built up your hand so that you can handle the jobs, if you will.
Yeah.
Like, if Kiwi had gotten a job at the end, he would have been screwed.
Oh, okay.
You had no money, no crew, like, you would have no negotiating.
I mean, that being said, everybody did get a job.
Yes.
Yeah, we all did get a job, and I did enjoy when you weren't the one on the job.
Yeah.
So, I think it does work.
And a couple times, I made sure I didn't get a job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there are a couple ones where I was like, I don't think I could really handle this one. My hand was terrible. Or I had some really good like twist cards, because those are so good.
Yeah.
They're like, those are the strongest negotiating ones. So if you have like two twist cards, you almost don't want to be on the job, because you can get more out of it.
That's true.
But I just always wanted a job as kind of from that strategic point, because that's where you're going to get the cash.
Because like at the end, Eric got one for like 300,000, I think.
Oh, yeah, my last job was worth a lot. And then, but I think we ended up the second to last one.
Yeah, but he ended up giving most of that money to you.
Yeah.
Yes,
he actually got less out of it than you did.
Yeah, because I used a twist and made him give me $150,000.
Yeah. Well, he played two twists to help me, and then he actually got more of the cut at the end, but I knew I had more, I thought I had more banked.
Yeah.
So I figured I would win, so I just needed to get through the job. But I did think that was kind of a fun piece of the game, that sort of negotiation piece. I like that. How about the rules?
I think we did have to go, like, we did learn it right before we played it. So that always makes it sometimes more difficult to teach and play a game sometimes. It makes it a little bit longer. But I think there were several times where we had to go into the rule book and reread stuff and then things that didn't necessarily make sense.
Mm-hmm.
So like the crew member piece, where once you use the crew member, if you use them so that they stay with you, you can't replace them the way the rules are written. But if you have more than one crew, I mean, I could see it as like, I've got guys all over the galaxy. Like, this guy got, you know, he's tired or whatever. So I stop at, you know, station X and I drop that dude off and I pick up this other guy that I have on my team. Like, I could see that as being a thing. Or like, I think Eric suggested during the game, like, you just can't switch out.
Yeah.
So like, once you use it, like, it's used and he just goes back in your stash when the job is over. And then there were a couple other little pieces where it was like, that's worded a little bit confusing, or we had to like read it out loud so that everybody could kind of get their piece in, like, okay, this is what I think it means. I think their rule book could have used a little bit more in terms of shoring it up. And then I think I would house rule a couple of things, like the bidding at the beginning. Like, I'm not a big fan of
it. Yeah, but I mean, that might be too big of a house
rule. You might be changing the whole game at that point. Yeah. But I think if you make a deal, you have to honor it that round, but you don't have to honor a deal that you make for a future round. So more along the lines of Sheriff of Nottingham.
Yeah, I just feel like, so when you say house rules, I do feel that the way that we want to tweak it is that we're starting to change the structure.
Well, I think that's a big one. I think changing the crew stuff around, I mean, we kind of talked about it, but like the way that it was almost better to have multiple crew and then sacrifice them and replace them so you have more stuff to play versus actually using them the way you should be using crew. So like that could be a simple house rule, I think. But
right.
But I think changing the way the bidding, and then that's going to change the whole.
Yeah. I want to just finish up with the crew stuff for a second, Paxton, and then I'll give you the mic. But it just makes me wonder on the playtesting how then they dealt with that type of situation. Was that just something they were like, it was explained clearly up front?
Right. Maybe we're just misinterpreting.
Yeah.
Or missing something. So how about player interaction?
That's one thing. I'm glad you brought that back up. We were making references and comparisons to Call to Adventure. And I think this is the exact opposite. Well, they're both story building with card management. Call to Adventure, of course, is much more almost a solo adventure with the occasional, I accidentally took the card you had been eyeing kind of game. Whereas this one is totally about not only building on the story from before, so having to repeat what the people had said, so you actually have to listen to them, but also, you know, there's a lot of backstabbing and negotiation, and it really is about the whole table and who you have at the table.
Yeah. Player interaction is inherent in a storytelling game. Like, we couldn't tell the story the way this game is set up without some sort of interaction, so I think there's a lot of player interaction in this game.
Was it much more of a collaborative storytelling versus Call to Adventure, which is more of a individual story building.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I thought it was good. It's kind of like a mix of Call to Adventure with more like a Sheriff from Nottingham with this stuff. And I think it kind of comes down to like how much you get into the storytelling. Gameplay wise, then Call to Adventure's stronger game.
Right.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're really into sort of this sort of theme.
Yeah.
And everything.
Yeah, I think
if you're getting into the storytelling and stuff, then it.
Yeah. And I think it's a fun, light theme as well, which makes it enjoyable. I just think all of us have that kind of preference towards Call to Adventure because we do like the whole backstory in D&D.
But I mean, I think you do the same thing. Well, not quite. It's not quite the same backstory building, but you do get a good storytelling out of
it. Oh, yeah.
So would you play it again?
I would. Kid was nodding his head.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would also play it again.
Yeah. I still love the idea of being a scoundrel. Even though I told the truth a couple of times and maybe a couple of lies, you will never know.
Yeah.
That's fair.
Hint, hint. She definitely told some lies.
You will never know.
Was it worth kickstarting?
Yeah. I mean, it was a pretty cheap game for what you're getting. I feel like one thing is it might be a little long. I feel like it does go on a bit.
That makes it more thrilling.
Overall, like it's fun. I like the storytelling aspect.
Yeah.
I would say if your group isn't into story, it doesn't get into stories, then it's probably not a good game for you.
Yeah.
Whereas like Call to Adventure, you could still get away with as a pure game. I don't think it'd be as fun. But if your group's into stories and like space western theme, then
I could see it being long. I just also feel that the length also helps you build.
It does.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was definitely a little on the longer side. But
all right, there you go. That is Galactic Scoundrels. We're going to be playing Tiny Epic Mechs, designed by Scott Alms of all the Tiny Epic games, Heroes of Land, Air, and Sea, Harbor, and also Coaster Park. It was developed by Michael Coe. The art is by Roland McDonald of Battleline, Western Legends, Werewords, Stop Thief, and Undaunted Normandy, and Benjamin Schulman, all the Tiny Epic games, Heroes of Land, Air, and Sea, and Herbaceous. It is published by Gamelin Games. It's the year 3030, and technology offers humankind unimaginable entertainment. What used to be virtual is now reality, and sports that once occupied your flat screen now occupy the world stage. The largest of these sports embodies the evolution and integration of athleticism and machinery. Hundreds of millions of viewers jack into the neural net feed from the battle arena, high up on the roof of the Aug Tech headquarters, witnessing the spectacle that is MEX, Mechanized Entertainment Combat Heroes. MEX is an acronym, of course.
Are you not entertained?
Gosh.
The mechanics are action, movement, programming, area control, area influence, grid movement, modular board, take that, and variable player powers. And the box art is here.
Yeah, it's got epics in small case lettering in kind of a neon style.
Very Tron kind of.
Yeah.
Kind of like a mix of like anime mechs and Tron.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then for those familiar with the Tiny Epic series, it's the same box size, everything of all their other Tiny Epic games.
What is that, like 4x6?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. With no inserts, everything kind of just fits snugly into it.
So based on all this, does this game interest you?
Yes.
Why?
The mechs.
Yeah. That's a fair assessment. Yeah.
Meeple mechs. I don't need to go any further.
Yeah, so for those who don't know, we'll get into the components a little after, but basically you have little meeples. They go inside mechs and you can attach different weapons on them, and it's kind of like building Legos?
Yeah, I think Game One calls them item meeples.
Okay.
So I-T-E-M, so item meeples. I don't know if they started it, but I think they definitely go big with it. So I know Tiny Epic Quest, Zombie, Tiny Epic Defender, like they kind of all have that same.
Right, but this takes it to a whole new level, right?
Yeah, I don't think they had any kind of like armor or anything like that. It was just like weapons and shields and stuff like that that you attach to your meeples. I think this is the first where they actually had stuff that your meeples went inside of, including the Mega Mech, which I think if you have the opportunity to get online and look at, like, that's just a cool thing to put a meeple in.
Yeah. So we'll see how that affects gameplay in our post wrap up. What about BP?
Nope.
No interest?
No.
Yeah.
I think I've only played Tiny Epic Galaxies and not a super fan. And I mean, while I watched Voltron as a kid, and I'm a huge Tron fan, even the video game, still, no. All nothing right. about, I mean, the readout reminds me of one of the Final Fantasies.
What was the Arnold Schwarzenegger movie where he's like in the, was it Running Man?
Oh,
where he's in the arena?
Yeah.
That's what, like, when I was reading the description and all, and like the entertainment piece, like that's what I was thinking of, Arnold Schwarzenegger and Running Man. There weren't any mechs in that, though.
Right.
Yeah. But talking about mechanized figures, I guess, for the history bit, reminded me one of my favorite podcasts. I know we talk about a lot of different podcasts. The Stuff You Missed in History class, hosted by Tracy B. Wilson and Holly Fry.
Shout out.
Total fans. They did a 5 historical robots episode. And so when Eric suggested maybe doing a quick history bit on robots, that's what I automatically thought of. Because, you know, yeah, there's the idea of when we became fascinated and started building like the Toyota robot that, right, they're using these days. And I think robotics have become much more prevalent in, you know, our 21st century life. But the podcast made me really rethink, like, what is a robot? And so they went kind of automatonic machinery. And so dating all the way back, I think it was, again, 11th or 12th century China, because again, everything origins in China. I mean, medieval China was just so much farther advanced than European nations. They talked about several, some of them that were walking in during the scientific revolution period. So 16th, 17th and 18th centuries. They have very delicate robots that were playing flute, for instance, like actual playing a flute. Hard enough for a human to play a flute.
Say what century again?
During the scientific revolution. I think the flute player may have been 17th or 18th century. And then one of our favorites, Paxton and mine, is there was this mechanical duck which could pick up grain, supposedly digest it, but obviously not really digest it because it didn't have the fluids inside of it. So basically ran through a bunch of tubes in its interior and then expelled it. So an automatic robotic pooping duck.
Okay, I had some hydrochloric acid in there and just...
You could have. I don't know. This was, I think, more 15th, 16th century that they... it was so cool that I did buy Paxton a shirt of it for Christmas.
When people talk about automata, I always think about the story that there was a somebody designed a chess automata that could beat anybody. And it was, but what it was a chess table and there was a guy inside that could see out and see the moves. Mm-hmm. And then he controlled the automaton to do the chess moves, but everybody thought it was the automaton doing the chess moves. But it was like a chess master inside the machine.
That's basically how software works.
Yeah. What's a chess master?
It's somebody who's super good at chess.
Oh, I thought you said chess.
Oh, no. Yeah, chess master. Chess. That would be like a bodybuilder. Again, going back to Arnold Schwarzenegger. He would be a chess master.
Moving on.
Yes.
All right. So during setup of the game, we'll go into rules. So... the board's built by randomly placing tiles, and it's based on the layout is based on the number of players you have in the game. And then players are going to be able to select their characters to be their pilots, and then one of four basic weapons to start with. After setup, the game's going to be played in six rounds. And at the end, the player with the most victory points is the winner. And then each round is broken up into three phases. So during the first phase, you're going to program. Each player has eight programming cards. Six of them have arrows. So you'll orient the arrows based on how you want your pilot or mech to move around on the grid. But they also have an action. So some of the actions are collect. Each of the grid spaces on the board has a lightning bolt for energy or money. And so you'll collect one item based on which one do you own. You own grids by placing gun turrets, mines, or having your pilot there. So you'll collect resources, essentially. Mm-hmm. You can purchase weapons. So there are basic weapons that you can purchase, or you can purchase advanced weapons. And the cost is printed on the card. So some will cost money, some will cost energy, or they could cost a combination of the two.
Does stockpiling money get you any victory points at the end?
No, stockpiling money does not get you any victory
points. Can we have that start of every rule section?
Just, okay. Got that, Paxton?
Yeah, I was going to buy all the weapons anyways.
Yeah. But you can stockpile as many as you want, and you can equip your mech as long as it's your turn and you're not in combat. Pilot cards, when you're just a pilot, you can only use basic weapons. Mm. If you're in power armor, you can use basic and advanced. And then if you're in the mega mech, you can only use advanced weapons. And then your other action is to deploy a mine or a turret. So each of the grid locations has a number value. So if you want to place a mine, you pay money based on the grid value. So if you put it on a two grid, you have to pay two money to put a mine there. For the gun turret, it's energy, and it's the same. You pay whatever that value is in energy to place a gun turret. And then finally, you can power up. So you can pay one energy to heal two health, or you can pay $5, five money, five credits, five simoleons, to upgrade into your power armor. Combat's initiated immediately once you move into another player's location. And combat just goes back and forth until someone has exhausted their weapons or they get KO'd. So the initiating player is going to get a victory point. Every time you do damage to the other player, both people, both the defender and the attacker, you'll get a victory point for every damage you do. If the other player retreats, you get a victory point. Or if you knock them out, you get a victory point. The cool part about whether you get knocked out or you retreat is you go into ad hoc mode. So you take off all the tiles that you've programmed. And you go into ad hoc mode, which means you can do any of your eight actions from your hand. The only thing you can't do is initiate combat, but other people can fight you. The last piece would be controlling the mega mech. So in order to gain control of the mega mech, you have to move your pilot, who is in his power armor with full health, into the location with the mega mech, and then you take over the mega mech. If you fight someone who's in the mega mech and you knock them out, you immediately gain control of the Mega Mech. And the one big difference, other than you get 4 advanced and there's tons of health, the Mega Mech has its own card. So you lose your pilot's special ability, but you get to choose which special ability you have for the Mega Mech. But you can't heal while you're at Mega Mech.
And it's kind of like a King of Tokyo.
Yeah, almost like, you
control the center.
Yeah.
You.
Yeah, but the Mega Mech, you can continue points, to walk around too.
Yeah, but it's kind of like you're in it until you get knocked out.
Yep. And then at the end of rounds 2, 4, and 6, we're also going to score. So every tile that you control, so mine, gun turret, or your pilot, you'll get the value of that grid in victory points, which will get tracked here. So that happens at the end of 2, 4, and 6. And then at the end of the game, if you're in the Mega Mech, if you have it at the end of the turn, you get 3 victory points as well. So the longer you keep the Mega Mech, the more points you get as well. And that...
I keep it took you.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So that's the game.
Let's play.
We just finished a game of Tiny Epic Mechs. To recap, BP had 39 points, I had 48, Paxton had 55, and Kiwi had 80. What was your winning strategy?
Well, one, I think I got lucky because I had a bunch of high point value grid spots next to me. And so I just tried to get as many territories as possible and tried to keep them. I didn't have as many towards the end because you guys were taking them. But I think I jumped out ahead in the beginning, and that's where I got most of my points, was the first like round 2 and round 4.
I would also like to point out your one weapon.
Oh, yeah, that was a pretty good weapon. Which one, the plasma cannon or the EMP mace?
The EMP mace
was pretty good.
Yes.
He had a weapon that disabled another player's weapon.
Unused weapon,
which is pretty... Combat is basically who has more weapons.
Yes.
So it's a pretty clutch card. I think BP and I had the same initial strategy of just building a little base. Then I went on an expedition across the map, and it did not go well for me.
Yeah, he went into one of my turrets after he got killed, and...
I was just a last-ditch effort to take out a turret from somebody with more points than me. Mostly I went after
killed you.
Kiwi's territory, and I did a little damage, but yeah. It didn't quite work out. I mean, the key part of the game is removing people's mines and turrets. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think I took out 2 of BP's and
a couple of
2 years before I got knocked back to my side of the map.
Yeah.
And took out none of mine.
All right, so... Theme. Let's start with Paxton.
I thought it was a pretty good theme.
Like overall, the whole mech battle arena.
Yeah, it kind of reminds me of BattleBots with like more lasers.
Which, to just let listeners know, there were actually no real lasers.
Yes. Yeah, there was.
Although every time I watch BattleBots, I have thought,
I have a laser blaster.
I wish there were more lasers in this.
I mean, most things just
and
a few more lasers.
Isn't a pulse pistol would kind of be a laser?
Sure.
BP?
What did I think of the theme?
Mm-hmm.
The same as I thought previously.
Yeah, so previously in a deep dive, you'd said tactical kind of combat games were not up your
right.
So we confirmed this to be true.
We have confirmed that they are still not my favorite.
Yeah.
So now, would you like this theme if it were a different type of game? No, still no...
Wait, the mechs, if it were a different type of game, possibly. Like, mechs don't sway me one way or another. Right. Like, zombies might deter me from something, or some kind of horror theme would definitely deter me from picking it up. I don't think mechs has that kind of distaste for
no
me.
No appeal.
It just, it's not one that I would readily run for.
Right.
There was an anime, Evangelion, that I watched for a while, and it kind of,
So, but for the theme and overall, just not, no appeal to you.
Yeah.
And then the fact that it's also kind of a tactical combat kind of
place. Right.
Yeah. Yeah, I like the theme. I mean, I did purchase the game a lot because of the theme, and I do like the mechs, and I thought the mechanics and the way the game played kind of fit into what they were trying to do, like the Running Man style, like battle to the death while people watch.
Right.
There is a small expansion. They have like a couple mini expansions in. Where there's cameras that you can add. So in the off rounds, where you're not scoring territories, if you defeated somebody in combat, a camera starts following you around in the arena and you get victory points in the off rounds if you have a camera following you.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I still like the theme overall, the home mech thing, battle arena, futurist. I still like the idea of the theme. How about the art?
I mean,
and components in general, because there's a lot more components.
There's a lot of components.
I do like while they're not necessary, just based on the way the game is played, because I don't have to have the items on the meeples themselves. All I really need are the cards, but it's just a kind of a cool addition. I would definitely say it's sort of a
fluff.
Yeah, I don't know.
Gimmick is like a word.
Gimmicky, but, yeah. I think the mechs and the plastic bits are definitely gimmicky.
Right.
And I think that's sort of what they were going for because they weren't a requirement.
Mm-hmm.
But it is cool to have that tactile, like, this is my mech and, like, this is what it, like, Paxton said it before, like, BP's character at the end, like, looks super cool.
Oh, yeah.
Like, she's got, like, a turret on one shoulder, a sniper rifle on the other, and then she's got a sword and shield. Like, it just looks cool.
Right.
Which you wouldn't get just looking at, you know, the cards in front of her, but seeing the meeple, like...
I have to say, though, I just had to weapon up because you kept attacking me.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you get points for attacking people.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall the art's pretty good. The arena art is a little bland. Yeah.
Yes.
That could have maybe been a little more interesting.
I mean, it looks like an arena, though.
You can make an arena that looks cooler.
So, Hunger Games arena?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, as much as I am not super into the theme or even into the game style itself, I think the art, it's not, again, like an art I'm super into, but it definitely, I think, helps make it interesting, mm-hmm. if that.
And I mean, like... I think the player cards and stuff, that's mm-hmm. really good. The components are good. I just think the arena itself could have a little more flair to it.
Yeah, I don't disagree with that.
And like the action cards are pretty clear.
Yes.
It's a good way. We did have the whole kind of, you pull your card down and cover it with another one.
Yeah.
A little tricky.
Yeah, trying to do the whole, it's kind of like, I don't think it's as much in Cult Express, but there's definitely like that. Okay, if I do this, like I end up going
right.
This there is, but the way, because in Cult Express, you just place the card and you don't have to worry about directionality.
So maybe
this one, you have to worry about the way the card is facing. So it just makes placing the card a little more.
Yeah, so maybe more mechs versus minions.
Yeah.
There were some like movement pieces in that where it's just like, ah, shoot, if I play this card, I'm going to end up going this direction. So that I remember watching everybody like kind of turning the card to be like, wait.
But then you had to place it in a
way. Yeah, and make sure. And like it happened to Paxton once where he accidentally flipped the card.
Right.
So the one he wanted was actually the covered one. And then he ended up going in the wrong direction as well.
Some mechanics.
Oh, yes. Oh, sorry. Stare at BP time.
Yep.
It's
actually right in the show notes. Again, it says stare at BP and then say mechanics.
I don't even know what the mechanics were. I mean, was there, wait, one that I've learned recently. A take that?
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yep, for sure.
Programmability is the other big one.
Is that the one with the steps that
and
we were struggling
control,
with?
Because you're controlling based on
what
you put together.
So. None of these are any that super attract me. I mean, I'm not opposed to a that take that mechanic, but the others.
So mechanically, it's very similar to Cult Express.
Right. Which, I mean, I enjoy playing with you guys, but I don't think it's a game that I would, go out of my way to go play.
Okay.
I didn't really notice any take that, besides when I demolished Eric.
So,
literally the summary of take
big,
that.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
But like, that was for me, I'm pretty sure that's, the only take that I noticed.
So, well, that specifically dealt with you, but remember... There's more players in the game, and they're like, I think I fought Bethany at least three times.
Well, you two fought twice, once.
We fought once. We fought
times.
Like two or three times. You and I fought once. So there were definitely, I think there was a fight at least every round. There might have been one round, maybe round two, mm-hmm. where nobody fought. But that was like the only round where we didn't fight. So there was a pretty constant take that.
All three of us got knocked out at least once.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah, that's pretty...
I think just you and I got knocked out. I think everybody else retreated. I don't think BP or Paxton ever got knocked out.
I never got knocked out.
Right.
Yeah, rules.
Fairly simple.
I don't know. I felt like they were reasonably simple-ish when you're reading and understand. We did have to... There were a couple
Sorry.
I mean, we had one question of reading the the way the hearts the heal up, based on, again, special powers.
What else did I have to look up? I did mess up and we had to go back and rescore because I forgot that turrets scored double for their location. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there were one or two other things that I had to look up. For such a small game, there were definitely a lot of rules.
I feel like there are a lot of rules for a small game.
Also for small.
Small box.
Once we It's a pretty sprawling game.
Yes. Yeah. It was definitely one of those ones where you needed to play through, I think, to be able to understand. Yeah.
And I think programming games in general are a little bit harder to explain just because it's that whole, hey, you're going to put these down at the very beginning, but you don't really know where you're going to be at when you get to action 3 and 4 because you could be somewhere else. I mean, the nice part is if you end up somewhere where you don't think you're going to be because of 3 or 4, like you're probably in ad hoc mode. You're going to get to do whatever you want anyway.
So like for me, I don't know that the programmability worked great in this game. Like, it's a mechanic that I like, but like the board is so, there's so much space that it was hard to kind of engage. And then the fact that like one person gets the Mega Mech, it's designed that you're supposed to team up on that person.
Right.
But that's hard to do with programmability because nobody knows where anybody's moving.
Right. Yeah.
So like the fact that you get in the Mega Mech towards the end of the game, it makes it hard to take you out because one, we've all got to gang up on you, which coordinating that is not always easy. Well, and then two, we've also all got to manage to program our way to you.
Yeah. And I think there were definitely opportunities for people earlier in the game to get the Mega Mech and they just didn't.
Right.
Well, because like, I thought Paxton was going to grab it like round two.
Yeah.
Right. But if you don't have advanced weapons, it really doesn't do anything for you.
I had a advanced weapon, but I was like, yeah, they all have two. So might as well like wait, and then like I never did it because I kind of forgot.
Like it may have been worth it, and I'm guessing that was kind of the goal of the game is you're all supposed to rush for the Mega Mech. We just didn't.
Yeah.
But
I forgot the Mega Mech couldn't use advanced weapons, and then I jumped into it and only had one.
Oh yeah.
One advanced weapon. So like I was set up very poorly.
Yeah, but I mean it still worked out for you because you were so hard to take down.
Yeah.
Because I attacked you pretty quickly.
Yeah, I mean I was down to one.
But you had the one. Very powerful weapon.
Yeah,
if I had jumped in like the time that Dad had jumped in, I would have had 3 advanced weapons.
Right.
Yeah. Player interaction.
Well, I think that goes with the programmability where the idea of it was to be, I think, a little bit more interactive with that piece.
Mm-hmm.
And there definitely was, right? That's the take that component. But as you said, like there were plenty of rounds. I just seriously went around in circles.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And even like when I made my way over to you, I was kind of wandering for a couple rounds before.
Yeah.
Got to
and you didn't combat. Even wander into, you just went into my territory and set off some mines. So
yeah.
We and then into Kiwi's territory. Yeah.
I think that like the opportunities for player interaction are definitely there. You know, walking into people's minds to gain their territory, you know, judging whether or not like, okay, I think they're going to, they have enough energy to mess me up with a gun turret or, hey, he has one energy. Like I can walk into this gun turret and either A, survive it if he uses it or B, just like he's probably not going to use it because he needs that energy for something else.
But that happened to me. You had one energy when I programmed to go to the turret. But by the time I got there, you had like 10 energy. And I was like, well, I can't go there anymore.
Right. So I think like they've designed it so that there is a lot of player interaction to fit into that take that mechanic. Mm-hmm. It just sometimes it's accidental and sometimes
it's kind of like
you've done it because you got lucky.
Right. And you could potentially not have. I mean, I probably, if I hadn't gone looking for the last fight, I could have just avoided direct confrontation pretty easily.
And I didn't. I kept getting attacked.
Yeah. Well, you were kind of between the two of us.
Yeah. So I was that little kingdom in the middle of the two big kingdoms.
Like a classic, like a Liechtenstein situation.
Would you play it again?
Yes, I would play it again.
You really want to play it again sometime soon?
Yeah.
Okay. Excellent. Well, maybe someone else at this table will play with you. I will not be one of those.
I would probably pass. I'm kind of with you. Tactical combat games don't really appeal to me that much. Unless you're going to go a full-on mini game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I was going to say.
Like a minis game as in like a...
Yeah. Flames of War.
Yeah.
Or I think the Spartacus.
Yeah.
Like that.
I don't really count. That's more... a lot of different...
Tactical.
Yeah. There's like a little piece of that in there.
I think I will keep it because Paxton loves it. And I will be the one that plays it with him. And I won't
mind it. Mm-hmm. I had fun playing it, but I don't think it's what we're looking for in a game.
What you're not looking for, what I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Different games for different people.
Yes.
Right.
And I think it's great that there is a game that you like, because we want you into the board gaming world as well. And so it's fantastic. And there will be lots of other people in the world who do love this game as well. And so
a lot of people love Tactic Game. I think we're more in the minority.
Yeah.
So does this go to two players?
Yes. So
I actually think that might be a more intriguing game because you know exactly who you're going to be.
Yeah. So four players is always laid out the way it is here. So it's a 3x3 grid with three tiles on each side. So it almost is a 5x5 with the corners taken out. And then they shrink it down for three players and then shrink it down for two players. Right. So the map gets smaller. And the bases get put in different locations when you scale down the number of players.
Right, because I think a lot of it was like, well, these two are fighting over here, I'm over here, mm-hmm. we'll see what happens there. And I think if you had two people, it's just kind of like arm up and go.
Great.
Yeah.
And that might be a little less trying to be tactical with the randomness. It's more just sort of like go at each other, BattleBot style.
Yeah. Go ahead.
I think is what Paxton would really enjoy.
Right.
Yeah. And then there's a solo mode as well where you fight two robots, basically. Okay. So you're That's like your own person and you play it on the three-player map. And then there's different, you know, based on what you draw, that's what the robot will do.
Right. Basically. Hmm. That makes sense.
So it seems like a very different game, too, in that instance.
Yeah.
But yeah, that being said, like, I don't think I would bring it out for us again. I think if we're going to go for a programming game, we'll pull out Cult Express and go for the chaos of that. But even then, like, I know BP is not big into Cult Express either.
Yeah, but I still have fun playing it with you guys.
Yeah.
I like that because it's more, you pretty much have something happen every round. Mm-hmm. Right. You don't have to worry about directionality and that. It's just more sort of run up and down the train and see what you smash into.
Yeah. And hope you can grab some loot.
Yeah. Right. So I'll keep playing it with Paxton. That'll be who I play it with.
That's good.
So if you have any game suggestions for us or any sort of feedback about our podcast, please hit us up on Twitter and Instagram at FirstTurnCast or shoot us an email, firstturntabletop@gmail.com. And you can find us, rate and review us on all of your favorite podcatchers. Thank you.
But you should be happy you get to sacrifice people again.
I know, right?
You should watch Code Geass.
Okay.
Gauss
Geass.
Gauss. Yeah, you've told me about it. Code Gauss. Maybe you haven't. Maybe that wasn't one.
That was apparently your other wife.
Yes.
Well, that's good in the outtakes.
A little awkward there, Kiwi. Oh.
Sell your soul. The one thing you would never do. Now you're doing it. For money.
Tell us how you're going to sell your soul.
I am on my way to take up my corporate job.
All right.
Giving up the scoundrel life.
I don't make a corp. It's an office job, 9 to 5.
Cubicle.